I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. The president calls it the collusion delusion. Attorney General William Barr summarized Robert Mueller's 300-page report in a 4-page letter to Congress. Chaos ensued. In a poll released today, 3 out of 4 Americans say the entire report should be made public. President Trump says he's exonerated and off the hook. Democrats in Congress don't quite agree. Investigations on numerous fronts continue. Joshua Gerstein of Politico and Darlene Superville of the Associated Press join me to take a look behind the headlines. Plus, veteran war correspondent and former NPR host Neil Conan and Carolyn Surik of Ensemble Galilei join me to talk about a program they're presenting tomorrow night inspired by soldiers. First, the news. Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us today for Midday and the Midday News Wrap. Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh, who was hospitalized for several days for pneumonia, gave a 20-minute press conference yesterday afternoon at City Hall. She called her arrangement with the University of Maryland Medical System, in which the system allegedly purchased 20,000 of her children's books, a regrettable mistake. On the advice of counsel, she did not take questions from reporters. She did display some paperwork associated with the books, and she spoke at some length about her clothing line for children. Many questions about the money that has changed hands between the mayor and UMMS remain, and clearly the mayor yesterday is not feeling as well as she hopefully will be feeling as she continues to recover from pneumonia. In Annapolis yesterday, Maryland legislators overrode a veto by Governor Larry Hogan to implement a statewide $15 minimum wage. Employees in businesses that employ more than 15 people will have to wait 6 years to reach $15 an hour. If you work in a smaller company, you'll have to wait until 2026. Comptroller Peter Franchot had some things taken off his plate by lawmakers yesterday. They overrode another veto by the governor that will change the way tobacco and alcohol are regulated. And legislation concerning when the school year should start is another veto override that is expected today. The governor thinks it should start after Labor Day, that is, school should start after Labor Day, as do many Marylanders who are polled on the subject. But the legislature thinks local jurisdictions should be able to decide for themselves. And in Washington, it's been a week since the Mueller report was delivered to Attorney General William Barr. President Trump has pronounced himself exonerated. Democrats aren't buying it. The president has also moved to completely dismantle Obamacare by joining a legal action that would eliminate the law and with it some of its most popular provisions, like coverage for pre-existing conditions. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has wished the president and Speaker Nancy Pelosi good luck in finding a suitable replacement for the ACA. Mr. McConnell doesn't seem interested in being part of that conversation himself. Our luck has been very good when it comes to our news wrap conversation today, in which we will focus on some of the big national stories that have occupied newsrooms this week. Joshua Gerstein is the senior legal affairs contributor at Politico. He joins us on the phone from Shanghai, China. Hey, Josh, welcome back.
Hey, good to be with you again.
And Darlene Superville covers the White House for the Associated Press. She's at the AP office in D.C. Hey, Darlene, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. So, Darlene, what's the mood at the White House? I mean, after the release of the letter from Attorney General Barr last Sunday evening summarizing the Mueller report, it seemed that the president and a lot of his advisors were doing a happy dance.
Yeah, I mean, to assess the mood at the White House, all that one had to do was tune into the rally the president headlined last night in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where he went on yet another victory rap, touting the findings, as Attorney General Barr summarized them, of the Mueller report, and said the collusion delusion is over. He pronounced the Russia investigation to be a hoax, and this is a theme that we're going to hear from the president quite frequently. He's pretty much, touted the findings of the report every day this week since Attorney General Barr released his his summary. So the mood is good in the White House right now.
And, of course, there's been any number of weeks where we've talked about, oh, my gosh, another disastrous week for the Trump administration, this catastrophe, that catastrophe. It's kind of rare when the White House has a real big win during the week. And this week they had not only the Mueller report, which they're accounting as a win, but also the Senate was not able to, or the Senate did not override the president's veto on the border wall executive order. So they have to be feeling like they're doing pretty well.
Right. All in all, I would sum it up and say that it was a pretty good week for President Trump, probably one of the best that he's had since he's been in office. And not only the Mueller report and Attorney General Barr's summary of those findings, and, as you mentioned, the House failing to override the president's veto of the national emergency declaration at the border, but you also had the president sort of basking in the praise of the Israeli prime minister, who was here on Monday, and the president finalized his decision to recognize Israeli control over the Golan Heights, which is a strategic territory bordering Israel. And that decision reversed decades of U.S. policy, but it's something that the prime minister of Israel has wanted for a long time, and President Trump went ahead and did that last week. And also, just out of the blue, we always knew the Mueller report was coming, right? But one thing that I don't think anyone saw coming were these charges against Michael Avenatti. And he's been one of the president's biggest tormentors in the public sphere and on Twitter. And now he's facing a lengthy jail time for allegedly trying to shake down Nike and for bank fraud and embezzlement. So you put all those things together, and the president had a pretty good week.
Indeed. And Josh Gerstein, the media, even prior to the Mueller report being released, and there was, breathless anticipation for the 48 hours when it seemed pretty likely that it was going to come out. Indeed, it did come out Friday afternoon, at least came to Attorney General Barr. People were warning the people on the left and Democrats to not be too optimistic about it. They were trying to sort of, I think, pre-soften the blow a little bit. What do you make of that, and what do you make of the backlash against people like Adam Schiff, the chair of the House Intel Committee? The president and others have not just had a victory lap; they've come out swinging against some of the folks.
Right, and I think that was an indication of how much folks on the left had invested in this report on cable television and elsewhere. Members of Congress, like you mentioned, Adam Schiff, who had been basically tormenting the president about this Russia issue for nearly 2 years now. And so it obviously is a disappointment in certain circles, at least in the way it's been framed by Attorney General Barr. But of course, the question here is whether what Barr set up was kind of another shoe that would drop down the road, that he sort of decided to eat the icing off the cake right away without really digging into what else might be in the report that will be made public. And so there was no legal requirement for Barr to put out a summary of the report. There was certainly no requirement for him to add this gloss on top of it that he and the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, who kicked off the Mueller investigation, added, saying that the president, in their view, basically had been exonerated on the issue of obstruction, even though the report itself says the contrary, or at least that he was not exonerated by the report, and apparently does contain facts that are negative or adverse to the president, but those facts weren't laid out. And now we all await the publication of this 300-some-odd-page compendium from Mueller to see what new information there may be in there that could influence the way this debate plays out, particularly in the House on Capitol Hill.
And we are expecting that the report is about 300 pages long, because evidently the Attorney General told Representative Jerry Nadler, who chairs the House Judiciary Committee, that that's how long it is. But there's still no definitive timetable for when we're going to have it, nor is there any understanding or any anticipation that Mr. Barr will allow the entire report to be released. There may be some things, even some substantial sections of it that are redacted. Josh, where does that stand in terms of when we might expect actually to be able to read it?
So the only specific time frame that the Justice Department has given us is to say that they expect it to be weeks, not months, before this is released. We also know that Attorney General Barr is likely to have to testify on Capitol Hill sometime in the second week of April about budget-related issues relating to the Justice Department. So obviously, if the report isn't out by then, or he can't promise a specific date by then, he's going to come under a lot of withering pressure and criticism up there on Capitol Hill. So that's sort of the timeline we're expecting in terms of what might be deleted from the report. The Justice Department has said, and Barr has said, if there's grand jury information, they're planning to take it out. And then there may be other reasons to take things out based on concerns about privacy, as well as the possibility, or what we know to be the fact, that there are at least some ongoing investigations. One of the things, the most intriguing things we'd like to learn from this report, is how many potential illegalities did Mueller come across and refer to other prosecutors. We know about things like the Michael Cohen situation being investigated by federal prosecutors up in New York City, and there are other matters being handled by federal prosecutors in Washington, D.C. and in Alexandria, Virginia. But I'm almost certain there must be other matters that Mueller ran across that have been handed off. And will we get a list of those, or will we be told that that's going to be tucked away to be announced at some point even further off in the future?
And Darlene Superville, NPR Marist PBS NewsHour poll that's just released today says that 3 out of 4 Americans want the entire report released. Democrats are taking the line that, you know, Mueller, according to Mr. Barr, has not found any chargeable offenses when it comes to conspiracy with the Russians or obstruction of justice. And the president does have, it seems, you know, perhaps a weeks-long head start in the PR battle about this, because he's crowing about what's happened based on the letter that Mr. Barr wrote to Congress last week. But is that going to fly? If it's redacted heavily, are the Democrats, do you think, going to end up still on their heels, depending on how it looks and, you know, what is actually included in the report once it's released?
In other words, will they be satisfied with redactions? Is that what you're asking?
Well, just also whether, you know, if it's heavily redacted, will the Democrats have any options? I mean, at that point, will they be able to, you know, sustain the argument that the president has acted in a way that even some people think he should be impeached for?
Yeah, well, you already have Congressman Adam Schiff, who is continuing to say that there was evidence of collusion. He, you know, the White House and other of the president's allies are calling on him to resign from the committee or to step down from Congress entirely. And he continues to say that there was evidence of collusion, so on and so forth. And I don't expect him to just suddenly drop that line of reasoning. Will they be satisfied? I mean, they can always continue to just demand for the full report, perhaps call for a classified briefing where they can, those that have clearance and the right to know, can know what classified material was in the report that the rest of the public and the rest of the members of Congress are not allowed to see. So they can continue to push this. The question is how.
And Josh Gerstein, one of the president's reactions after this report was to shift rather immediately and evidently somewhat to the surprise of some of the folks in his administration, and even over the objections of people like Mr. Barr and even his chief of staff, to shift focus to the ACA and a lawsuit that would eliminate the law entirely, essentially. What do you make of that particular pronouncement and If the that legal action is successful, what would happen to the ACA as we now know it?
Well, it would be taken apart, basically. And this is really a lawsuit that's based down in Texas that was filed by, I think it's by states that are opposed to the ACA, the Obamacare law. And we knew that the Justice Department under President Trump was going to take a different approach to this litigation, and had basically agreed with the conservative states challenging the law, that several of the key aspects of the law were unconstitutional. What kind of hit people as a surprise was that the Justice Department said that the whole law, like every word of it, should be struck down. And what's really surprising as a political matter is that this is an issue that Republicans like to talk about when President Obama was in office, but that they've really struggled with under President Trump to come up with any kind of an alternative proposal. Obamacare law seems to be fairly popular. Many Democrats credit the president's discussion about repealing it with helping to drive the Democratic victory last November, where they took over the House of Representatives. And so there's some concern, at least politically, among some allies of the White House that there isn't really a good backup plan here. It's also unclear how they would implement any kind of legislation, given that now you have Democrats in control of the House. And so there's just a lot of surprise that the president would choose to turn back to this subject that a lot of Republicans consider a politically painful one, despite the fact that repeal and replace was their mantra for, you know, a couple of years anyway. And there were dozens and dozens of votes in the House of Representatives to repeal the Obamacare law. It's something that they then didn't really want to follow through with during the 2 years they had where they could have passed something like that under Trump.
Josh Gerstein is the senior analyst for Politico. Darlene Superville covers the White House for the Associated Press. Darlene's in Washington. Josh Gerstein is in Shanghai, China. I'm here in Baltimore. You're listening to Midday. We appreciate that. When we come back, you can join our conversations if you have questions for Josh Gerstein or Darlene Superville. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday on Midday, the unrest that shook Baltimore in 2015 happened under an intense media glare and at a low point in our city's history. Recent political scandals and searing New York Times Magazine article 2 weeks ago lamenting the tragedy of Baltimore drive a narrative of hopelessness about our city, but in some circles, Baltimore is considered one of the most diverse up-and-coming metropolitan areas on the East Coast. On Monday, reaction to the article in the Times from Visit Baltimore CEO Al Hutchinson, Kirby Fowler of the Downtown Partnership, and Bishop Douglas Miles. He's one of the founders of the social justice organization BUILD. That conversation coming up Monday on Midday. If you've just joined us today, it's the Midday News Wrap. Josh Gerstein is a senior analyst with Politico, and Darlene Superville covers the White House for the Associated Press. If you'd like to join our conversation, our number is 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. To follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWIPR. Darlene, let me follow up with one other mention of this new preoccupation or re-preoccupation of the president with Obamacare. And that was the very unusual statement about this from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who basically seemed to be washing his hands of the whole affair and wishing Mr. Trump and Nancy Pelosi all the best as they worked out a deal. That seems kind of unprecedented, doesn't it?
Yes, in a way, but in another way, not so much, I would say. If you remember back during the government shutdown, which 35 days, the longest in our history, there was a period in time there when McConnell just sort of disappeared from the entire process, right? It was something that Trump had created for himself, and he kind of the mind that Trump should figure out how to get out of it. Eventually, you know, the pressure mounted, the shutdown dragged on, and McConnell eventually stepped back into the picture and tried to help put an end to this. And I think there is a similar thought process here where he, first of all, some Republicans are very puzzled about why the president made this quick pivot to health care again when at the top of the show we were talking about what a good week he had had. He's been riding high on the findings in the Mueller report, and conceivably could have just you know, ridden this out for the entire week and not stepped on the message, right, by pivoting to healthcare. So there's some puzzlement over that. I think Senator McConnell certainly is in that camp. There's no evidence right now that congressional Republicans, the White House, HHS, or any of the agencies that would be involved in coming up with a comprehensive healthcare plan are actually trying to do that. So I think Senator McConnell kind of maybe sees this as a lost cause and just doesn't want to be a part of it.
Yeah.
If he doesn't have to be.
If he doesn't have to be. If he can avoid it, he'll do everything he can.
Exactly.
Let's go to the phones to Adam in Baltimore. Adam, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make two quick comments. I think the pivot to healthcare by the president is just another example of his political ineptitude. He kind of blindsided his party with this. It's a losing issue for Republicans, and Democrats won on it in the midterm. And I think the cause of it is, I think it's, you know, the president is a creature of spite and vengeance, and he looks as the Mueller, you know, the partisan memo by the attorney general as a vindication, and he just wants to run with it. And I just think he's a creature of spite and vengeance, and that's what this whole thing is about. So that's my comment. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for that call, Adam. And Josh Gerstein, I mean, to look at him in Grand Rapids, Michigan last night, it sounded like anything he mentioned, including health care, was going to be a winning issue as far as he's concerned. I mean, obviously, repealing and replacing Obamacare was something that he campaigned on. He even went so far as to be very disrespectful, if I may, to the memory of John McCain, who he still blames for squelching the deal to repeal Obamacare when Mr. McCain was still alive and in the Senate. He doesn't seem to think this is a political miscalculation at all. What do you make of it?
No, and it often seems like he is trying to or planning to rerun the 2016 presidential race, both with the subject matters that he wants to talk about and with the tactics of basically giving his base the red meat that they are interested in, which, you know, obviously succeeded for him in 2016. And the big question for 2020 is, will the same tactics, the same approach, and even the same focus on policy issues and so forth, will that provide him with the votes that he needs to get reelection? And I, you know, the jury's out on that and still will be out for some period of time. But I don't see any indication that he's planning to change his approach because he seems to view that making these polarizing kinds of statements, or even sometimes making arguments like on healthcare that seem to go against the polls, will somehow pay off for him in the end. And that seems like the strategy, or at least the approach that he's committed to.
Yeah, he seems like he is sticking with what works. And Darlene Superville, speaking of what works, there's something that's not working at all in Britain. Today is Brexit Day. It was the day that the European Union and England, or Great Britain, were going to part ways. There was another vote that just happened within the last couple of hours, and Parliament has once again rejected, this is the third time, rejected a deal that Prime Minister Theresa May is trying to negotiate to have something of an orderly exit from Brexit. You wrote a piece about how the president chimed in about this very subject just a couple of weeks ago when the Irish Prime Minister was visiting around St. Patrick's Day. I'm not going to ask you to explain what happened at Brexit because no one on earth is capable of doing that. But in terms of, I mean, will Brexit play into in any way into the American election as the 2020 race gears up? What do you think?
I doubt it. But, you know, a couple of weeks ago, as you mentioned, when the Irish Prime Minister was here, Brexit obviously was a topic of their conversation, and the president used the opportunity to, again, sort of turn the knife in Theresa May's back just a little bit more by saying that he had given her advice on how to negotiate this Brexit deal, and she didn't take it, and he seemed to be blaming her for the troubles that Britain is in right now. But I don't really see Brexit playing out in the 2020 campaign. I see, as Josh mentioned, you know, the president kind of sticking to the playbook that got him elected in 2016, sort of rerunning that again in 2020 and focusing on healthcare, on immigration, on trade deals. He talked a lot last night about all the auto companies that are flooding back to the U.S. because he's president and with the policies that he's putting in place. So he'll focus on those things that got him elected in 2016 to try to have a repeat victory in 2020.
And Darlene, does that, for example, the claim about the auto industry, and he's making this claim in Grand Rapids, in Michigan, an auto-based state, do those claims that he was making last night stand up to scrutiny? I mean, saying things that are true?
not entirely. He stretches and embellishes a little bit, and it seems as though almost every day when he's talking to the press, he'll say, you know, and some automaker just announced that they're coming back to the U.S. But GM, for example, has taken a lot of heat from the president for deciding to close four plants or factories in the U.S. and another in Canada. Thousands of jobs are involved there, and he's been very vocal. He was very vocal on Twitter last week about that. Had a conversation with Mary Barra, who is the head of GM, about this. There is another car company that is, I believe it's Fiat Chrysler, that is doing some retooling in Michigan. But that was done, it takes years for car companies to decide to make a new car, to build a new line. So while Fiat Chrysler is doing something new, it really doesn't have anything to do with President Trump because it was all started before he became president.
And Josh Gerstein, you wrote a piece in Politico about a pick for the number three spot at the Department of Justice being rejected, not by Democrats, but in this case by Republicans. Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general we thought was going to be leaving the Justice Department earlier this month, he's still there. But there are some key positions at Justice that are as yet still unfilled. Where do things stand, and who was the nominee that was rejected or who withdrew her name, and what's she all about?
So this was Jessie Liu is her name, and she's currently the U.S. attorney in the District of Columbia, which means she's sort of the chief federal prosecutor for the city. It's probably a more important role than it sounds in that respect, in that there are a lot of cases that the Justice Department directs to that office, for example, people who are being prosecuted out of the Benghazi attacks in Libya, that's handled by the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C., just as a matter of how the Justice Department handles things. So it's a very important job, and it's a big office, and she was basically slated to get a promotion from that job to the number three position, Associate Attorney General at the Justice Department. Again, a very important job for Justice Department policy, as well as a lot of different divisions, including civil rights and environmental enforcement, both issues that are, you know, broadly important, but I think also important to the Trump administration. And so it was just this post has been vacant for, I think, about 13 months or so since the resignation of the woman who held it before, whose name was Rachel Brand, who went to take a corporate job at Walmart. And now Jessie Liu was announced, the intent to nominate her was announced earlier this month, about 3 weeks ago. And then very suddenly, yesterday afternoon, we got an announcement from the Justice Department that they won't be proceeding with the nomination. President won't be proceeding with the nomination. Jessie Liu will remain as the prosecutor in Washington and get another sort of internal upgrade at the Justice Department. And the reason for this is conservative Republicans were uncomfortable with one particular aspect of her resume, that she had been, I think, the vice president or vice chairman of a women's lawyers group that had opposed Justice Alito's confirmation to the Supreme Court and also had articulated a position in favor of abortion rights. And as far as we know, that association alone was sufficient to basically deep six her potential nomination or expected nomination for this job.
And Darlene Superville, you wrote a piece about another topic that has to do with Venezuelan politics. The wife of the opposition leader, Juan Guaido, was visiting the White House and met with Mr. Trump and Vice President Mike Pence. She's trying to rally support for the ouster of President Nicolas Maduro. Melania Trump was involved in some of these meetings as well, as a fellow, you know, co-first lady or alleged first lady. I'm not sure what to call Mrs. Rosales. But what is Melania Trump's role in this administration? Was this and this meeting, for example, is that indicative of the kind of contribution that she is making in this job?
Yeah, it's not unusual for first ladies in the United States to meet with first ladies from other countries, particularly when they come to the White House and come with their husbands, who often are the leaders of their countries. You'll have the presidents go off and meet, and then the first ladies often go off and meet, have tea, do a tour around town or something like that. So I didn't find it all that unusual that she would meet with Fabiana Rosales, who is the wife of Juan Guaido, who is the individual that the United States and scores of other countries around the world recognize as the legitimate president of Venezuela. What I did find unusual was, one, that they met without a corresponding meeting between the two presidents. Two, the meeting was at Mar-a-Lago. The White House didn't say who asked for the meeting, whether it was the First Lady asking, Melania Trump asking to meet with Ms. Rosales, or the other way around. Melania Trump has been in Florida for the past week or so. Her son is on spring break from school, and they always spend it down in Palm Beach. And Ms. Rosales has been on a tour of the U.S. She was in New York earlier this week. She came to Washington, as you mentioned, and then she was doing some events in the Miami area. So someone requested a meeting. We don't know exactly who. And that's pretty much all that I know about it. One thing they did talk about, according to a readout, a statement the White House put out last night, was that they talked about children in Venezuela, and First Lady Melania Trump has made children and child well-being and betterment and safety online the issue that she is championing while she is in the White House. And as we know, unfortunately, a lot of people in Venezuela, including children, are suffering given what's going on there with the political and the economic turmoil.
And Josh Gerstein, we just got 20 seconds left, but I was fascinated that Politico had a story today about Steve Bannon, who appeared on Squawk Box on CNBC, I guess this morning, and suggested that a Kamala Harris Beto O'Rourke ticket would be the toughest pair to face off against Mr. Trump in the 2020 election. What are the chances that Mr. Bannon's going to become a full-time Democratic consultant?
Well, you sometimes do hear sort of politicians or analysts on both sides occasionally putting together some kind of a fantasy team, if you will, to go up in competition against folks on their own side. So I don't know that the Democrats will be looking for a lot of advice from Bannon in the coming election. He seems like somebody who provokes derision just about every time that he's brought up, or alarm in some circles. So I don't think you'll hear a lot of people heeding that particular view, although there clearly are a bunch of folks who think Kamala Harris and Beto O'Rourke are very impressive candidates for the 2020 race.
And, of course, the last time the Clinton campaign assumed that their opponent would be Marco Rubio, and we know how that all turned out. Well, Josh Gerstein, senior analyst for Politico, is joining us from Shanghai. Thank you so much, sir. I appreciate it.
Sure, Tom. No problem.
And Darlene Superville covers the White House for the Associated Press. Darlene, thanks to you as well. Have a great weekend.
Thanks. My pleasure, Tom.
Coming up after a break, a unique collaboration involving music and memoir. Veteran journalist Neil Conan and Carolyn Surik join me to talk about a new project with Ensemble Galilei. Before we head to the break, we want to thank Bottoms Up Bagels for providing lunch today. Bottoms Up Bagels is a small-batch pop-up bagel shop preparing hand-rolled New Jersey-style bagels, house-cured lox, and specialty cream cheeses. Inspired by traditions of bagel making dating back to the 1940s, Bottoms Up Bagels offers customized catering packages of all kinds. You can find them at the Waverly Farmers Market and at bottomsupbagels.com. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.